You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
Listeners are likely to be familiar with the iconic image of the snail in the ginger beer bottle, which gained significance in Donoghue and Stevenson, the case in which Lord Atkin famously pronounced that recovery in tort should be limited to persons who are so closely and directly affected by my act that I ought reasonably to have them in contemplation as being so affected. When a person suffers a tortious injury, the injury often gives rise to losses on the part of others, for example, employers and family members. In general, however, the law does not allow recovery by such secondary victims. Since the early 1980s, an exception came to be recognised in cases where secondary victims suffered what has been described as a nervous shock, having witnessed the death or injury of a primary victim. Here with me to discuss recent developments in secondary victim claims is Gideon Barth, a barrister at 1 Crown Office Row. Gideon, I am delighted to welcome you back to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Unlike primary victims, secondary victims are those who have not suffered physical injury themselves, but suffer a psychiatric injury from witnessing the death or injury to others in quite specific circumstances. Could you tell us about those circumstances?
Sure. So ever since the cases of McLaughlin and O'Brien and Alcock and Chief Constable of South Yorkshire Police, the first being a road traffic accident case, the latter being the cases arising out of the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, the House of Lords have been keen to make clear that there must be control mechanisms for claimants to recover as secondary victims. Some of those are now well known and well established. First, there must be a close relationship of love and affection between the primary victim and the secondary victim, such as a marital or parental relationship. The second is that the injury arose from the sudden and unexpected shock to the claimant's nervous system. And that just shows how dated these cases are, because experts no longer really talk about nervous shock or unexpected shock. The third and the fifth, which are probably sensibly considered together, can be grouped in what's called proximity. So the claimant, the secondary victim, has to be personally present at the scene of the accident, or more or less in the immediate vicinity of the accident, and witness the aftermath shortly afterwards. That's physical proximity. And the fifth is temporal proximity. So they must be there and discover and find out about the accident at the time or shortly thereafter. And the fourth is that the injuries to the secondary victim arose from witnessing the death of or extreme danger or injury to the primary.
You and I would both have experience of advising clients who, for example, come across a fatal accident or in clinical negligence contexts, psychiatric claims on behalf of mothers and sometimes fathers during or immediately after labour. But it's true to say that recent trends have tended against recoverability for psychiatric harm, particularly those involving clinical negligence and or hospital settings, although there have been some exceptions. And the recent decision in Paul and Wolverhampton, handed down in June, will be of interest to anyone practising in this area. So can you tell us a little bit about the background of the case?
So the facts of this case are that in January 2014, the deceased, Mr. Paul, was out with his daughters, then aged 12 and 9, when he collapsed, fell backwards and hit his head, and he sadly passed away. The heart attack that he suffered, which led to the collapse, was caused by ischemic heart disease and occlusive coronary artery atherosclerosis. The claimants argued that there was a failure to perform a coronary angiogram in November 2012, some 14 and a half months earlier, which would have revealed the disease and then would have been treated, avoiding his heart attack and collapse. The defendant applied to strike out the claim, and that application was successful, and the claimants then successfully appealed the strikeout.
And where is the main area of disagreement?
Well, the main battleground for these sorts of claims in recent years, and indeed the one in Paul and Wolverhampton, was the proper interpretation of the requirement for proximity, i.e. that there must be close proximity in time and space between the secondary victim and the event. In particular, what is the event and what must there be close proximity to?
In his judgment, Mr. Justice Chamberlain provides a comprehensive review of the authorities, and in particular he mentions three key cases. Confusingly, two of these are called Taylor. Can you tell us a little bit about the first of these?
Sure. Taylor and Somerset Health Authority is a 1993 case where a secondary victim claim failed. In that case, a man suffered a heart attack at work. He died then after being taken to hospital. His wife, the claimant, was told of his death 20 minutes later by the doctor at hospital and then went to identify his body. The negligence which took place was over a series of months before ultimately culminating in his death. What was important about Taylor, and it wasn't particularly significant at its time, but was then picked up in the next Taylor case that we'll discuss, is that Mr. Justice Auld, in his judgment, said this: there are two notions implicit in the exception cautiously introduced and cautiously continued by the House of Lords. They are of one, an external traumatic event caused by the defendant's breach of duty, which immediately causes some person injury or death. And two, a perception by the plaintiff of the event as it happens, normally by his presence at the scene or exposure to the scene and or the primary victim, so shortly afterwards that the shock of the event as of its consequence is brought home to him. Now, in this case, Mr. Justice Auld, on that basis and that analysis, said there was no such event here, other than the final consequence of Mr. Taylor's progressively deteriorating heart condition, which the health authority, by its negligence many months before, had failed to arrest. And then his body was transferred to hospital, and when Mrs. Taylor was informed of what happened, seeing the body then did not constitute such an event. And that's starkly similar to the facts of Paul, where you could have argued that Mr. Paul's heart attack was just the consequence of a progressively deteriorating heart condition, which Royal Wolverhampton initially, by its negligence, had failed to stop.
Mr. Justice Chamberlain then referred to a Court of Appeal case from 2002, which is considered one of the high watermarks of these cases for claimants.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In Walters and North Glamorgan, the Court of Appeal found for the claimant. In that case, a baby was aged 10 months and admitted to hospital. He was mistakenly diagnosed with hepatitis A, but was in fact suffering from acute hepatitis leading to liver failure, and the trust admitted negligence in that case. The baby was kept in hospital, but was allowed home at the weekends. At one weekend, he was readmitted when his condition deteriorated, and the mother, the secondary victim in this case, awoke to see her baby making choking noises. There was a blood-like substance coming from the baby, and he was stiff. The mother was informed and understood that this wasn't life-threatening, although that was in fact wrong. A later CT scan showed a diffuse brain injury. Ultimately, she was told at a subsequent hospital to which he was transferred that he had severe brain damage, the chances of success were 50-50, and his life support machine was turned off. In that case, the Court of Appeal had to consider what an event was, and in this context, it was considered whether a 36-hour progression from the initial injury when the baby was choking until the death could be considered an event. Lord Justice Ward considered an event and described it as follows: a useful metaphor, or at least a convenient description, for the fact and consequence of the defendant's negligence, or the series of events which make up the entire event, beginning with the negligent infliction of damage, through to the conclusion of the immediate aftermath, whenever that may be. On the facts of this case, there was an inexorable progression from the moment when the fit occurred as a result of the failure of the hospital to properly diagnose and then to treat the baby. So in this case, the Court of Appeal did not kick out the claim on the basis that Taylor and Somerset Health Authority failed, that there needed to be an external traumatic event. Clearly in North Glamorgan and Walters, this was a negligent omission, not an external traumatic event. There also wasn't a comment, as later was argued about, about the time between the negligence and the traumatic event which was focused on by the court. Interestingly, this case has been used to show that there's quite a degree of flexibility in the description of an event, while previously you may have considered that an event had to be one single moment in time. A 36-hour period in this time was allowed to constitute an event.
And then we know that the mood music changed a little the next time the Court of Appeal dealt with this in 2013 in our second Taylor case, and this is Taylor and A. Novo. Can you tell us a little bit about the background to that case?
Certainly. And Taylor and A. Novo has been a difficult case for everyone to deal with ever since. In that case, a woman sustained an injury to her head and foot at work caused by the negligence of some wrecking boards falling on her. She initially made a good recovery, but died 3 weeks later, unexpectedly, from a DVT and a pulmonary embolism. The daughter didn't witness the event at work, but witnessed her collapse later and her death, and brought a secondary victim claim on that basis. The trial judge considered that the event was the death. On appeal, however, Lord Dyson, the Court of Appeal, found for the defendant. Lord Dyson considered that the event was the falling of the stack of wrecking boards at work. That had two consequences. The first was the injury to the woman's head and foot. The second was her death later. And in that case, the claimant wouldn't be able to recover because it was the later consequence of the event rather than the initial injury which she witnessed. Perhaps more difficultly, and the reason that the first Taylor case is important, is that Lord Dyson went on to endorse what Mr. Justice Auld had said in the first Taylor case, that there has to be an external traumatic event which more or less immediately causes injury or death. Now, the Court of Appeal in Taylor considered Walters, but distinguished it, rather than saying it was wrong. So we were left in a position where two incompatible Court of Appeal judgments in Walters and Taylor for litigants to then struggle with going forward.
And so following Taylor and A. Novo, how did litigants and the courts react?
Well, defendants realised that Taylor and A. Novo could be used as an argument that where there was a delay between the negligence and the injury, you could argue that there was not sufficient proximity as required by the control mechanisms. So there were a number of cases in the county courts and the high courts in which claims were struck out. For example, in Morgan and Somerset Partnership NHS Foundation Trust, a judge held that there was not the necessary element of proximity to the negligence on the one hand and the horrifying event, namely the heart attack, on the other. Similarly, in Tanner and Sarkar, in that case, a boy got the flu and was taken to hospital, where the alleged negligent omission took place. He was then taken home. His brother then awoke that night and witnessed his deterioration, and an ambulance was called and he was taken to hospital bleeding. The judge in that case found the only event capable of constituting the relevant event in law was the defendant's tortious omission to refer him for urgent treatment, i.e. the omission at the hospital. That omission caused immediate harm to him by allowing his condition to further deteriorate untreated. That consultation was not of itself a shocking and horrifying event and was not therefore capable of causing psychiatric injury to the claimant. And the same thing happened in the very recent case of Purchase and Ahmed, also a case struck out on the basis of Taylor and A. Novo.
So if we go back to Paul and Royal Wolverhampton then, in light of the case law you've described, things were not looking good for the claimant.
That's absolutely right. There was a 14 and a half month delay between the breach of duty and the shocking event, the heart attack. And that then led to the strikeout by Master Cook. And he said this: to focus simply on the death of Mr. Paul as being the first point at which the consequence of the defendant's negligence became apparent is not an approach which is supported by the authorities. To do so overlooks entirely that there must be a proximate connection between the initial negligence and the shocking event. It is this proximity in space and time that allowed Lord Oliver to impose the duty of care. So the claimants appealed that strikeout, and the case was heard by Mr. Justice Chamberlain. It's worth first dealing with two points which weren't argued by the defendant. but which seemed to have been the basis for a number of strikeouts. The first, Mr. Justice Chamberlain said, was that the event does not have to be synchronous, or more or less at the same time, as the negligence. So any argument that Taylor and De Novo was authority, that the negligence and the traumatic event have to be at the same time, is unsupported by authority. And in fact, as I said, the defendant didn't really seem to argue this on appeal. The second point, perhaps an obvious one, is that the negligence in a secondary victim case can be either an act or an omission. And again, the defendant didn't argue that, and a point unsupported by earlier authorities.
So what was the defendant's case?
Well, the defendants argued that the claimants had to be present at the scene of the tort. Now, that comes from the language used in the original cases where the claimant had to be proximate, have sufficient proximity to the scene of the accident. Now, in accident cases, the tort and the accident or the injury happen at the same time. And that was the basis on which the defendant argued that the claimants in this case weren't present at the scene of the tort because Mr. Paul suffered more or less immediately after the breach of duty. So his diagnosis was missed and there was a continuation and a worsening of the underlying illness. Mr. Justice Chamberlain held that in a case where there is no damage caused, and so it is significantly later, the tort is not complete until the damage occurs. And so the event must be when the damage occurs later on. In fact, even if Mr. Paul, the primary victim, did suffer damage, as argued by the defendant, right at the beginning, Mr. Justice Chamberlain thought that that did not necessarily mean the claim could be struck out. And paragraph 78 and 79 are important parts of that judgment. In effect, what the judgment says is that even if damage is sustained, it's not until it becomes evident or manifest that the event arises. Now, I think these are going to be tricky paragraphs to interpret going forwards. It may be that defendants argue that the primary victim suffered some injury shortly after the negligence, but the event, the shocking event, did not take place until later, and that perhaps the language of paragraph 79 of this judgment gives them a means by which to argue that and to dismiss the claim. In my view, claimants shouldn't be too concerned about this, because in Walters, the negligence occurred substantially before, and the baby continued to be very sick up to the time when the event started for the purposes of what the Court of Appeal considered the event, when the baby was having a fit.
So how did Mr. Justice Chamberlain deal with these two Taylor cases in his judgment?
Well, this is where the defendant, I think, thought that they had the most chance of success, because those cases, they argued, were authority that this incident was simply not capable of giving rise to a secondary victim claim. Mr. Justice Chamberlain effectively rejected that argument, that there must be some external traumatic event to found a secondary victim claim. He tackled that obvious inconsistency between the Taylor cases and Walters, which was clearly a medical negligence omission case. How could an external event be required? But in Walters, there was no external event. And the way through was that he interpreted the judgment in Taylor and Somerset of referring to an external traumatic event to be something external and traumatic to the secondary victim rather than to the primary victim, thereby making Taylor and Somerset and Walters fit together. When it comes to Taylor and De Novo, Mr. Justice Chamberlain said that this was clearly an accident case, essentially where the damage and the negligence occur at the same time, and limited it to those facts, distinguished it on that basis. And Taylor and De Novo could not apply to restrict cases where there was delay between the negligence and the damage, which was different to the facts of Taylor.
So where does this leave those advising on secondary victim claims?
So there's significantly more clarity on the issue of proximity. The confusion which reigned after Taylor and De Novo, and in my view had no good basis in the House of Lords authorities, has been cut back. Claims can now succeed, or perhaps can again succeed, on the basis of a negligent act or omission, which only subsequently causes evident damage. there remains one issue, that there may be an argument about when that evident damage arises. It may be that the judgment in Paul gives a slightly different hurdle for claimants to overcome, and it will be interesting to see how future courts apply this judgment and the judgment in Walters in cases of negligence causing damage in the future. But for now, the pendulum has definitely swung back in the favour of claimants.
We will include links to all the cases referred to in the blurb accompanying this episode on the UK Human Rights blog. Gideon, many thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.